Today is Tuesday, February 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, another death linked to the coronavirus outside of China has been confirmed. We learned today about the impact the virus has on the people it affects.
What we know for now, that there is not a specific treatment available at this time.
Plus, as U.S. senators wind up their impeachment trial, the president prepares to give his State of the Union address. And February 4th is World Cancer Day. Those stories and more are all next. Hong Kong officials say there has been a death link to the novel coronavirus. The news comes as hospital workers in the city continue their work stoppage. The AP's Charles de Ledesma starts us off.
Hong Kong hospitals have cut services as medical workers strike for a second day to demand the border with mainland China be shut completely to ward off a virus that's caused its first death in the semi-autonomous territory. The patient who died was a man who had travelled to Wuhan, the mainland city at the centre of the outbreak, before being hospitalised in Hong Kong. All but two of Hong Kong's land and sea crossings with the mainland were closed at midnight after more than 2,000 hospital workers went on strike on Monday. Hong Kong's hospital authority says it's had to cut back services because of a large number of staff members are absent from duty. And it says emergency services in public hospitals have been affected. In a parallel development, the leader of the nearby gambling enclave of Macau has asked the city's casino bosses to suspend operations to prevent further infections after a worker at one of the resorts tested positive for the virus. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
World markets recovered slightly Tuesday, with Chinese stocks reversing some of a previous coronavirus-related plunge amid official efforts to soothe nerves over the spreading outbreak. Market sentiment remains fragile, with oil near 13-month lows. Anxiety over the coronavirus eased some $400 billion in market value from Shanghai's benchmark index Monday. But a day later, the Shanghai composite closed up 1.3% and Hong Kong's Hang Seng rose 1.2%. In an effort to stem losses, China's state-backed Securities Times called on investors not to panic. European shares followed Asia higher, extending their recovery after last week's sell-off. In commodity markets, oil prices clawed back ground as hopes rose that OPEC and its allies would cut production to offset any drop in fuel demand. The outbreak continued to expand, with overall death tolls reaching at least 400. So, what do we know about how the coronavirus affects those who have it? That's the question I put to Dr. Francesca Torriani, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Clinical Epidemiology at UC San Diego Health.
It appears that this behaves like a cold virus. As you know, coronaviruses, basically it's a variety of presentations, right? Four of these coronaviruses that infect humans are responsible for the common cold. And so presentations might vary from the common cold to a very severe pneumonia with super infection and needing intensive care and ventilation. And so there's really a very wide variety of symptoms and severity of disease. But when we look at the mortality rates that have been so far reported out, and this is mainly from China and from the Wuhan region, we see that the mortality rates are lower than those reported for SARS.
Over the weekend, Thai physicians released information saying that a combination of flu antiviral medications and HIV antiviral medications seem to negate the effect of a patient there with the coronavirus. Does that tell us anything about the strength or the way that the coronavirus behaves?
What we know for now, that there is not a specific treatment available at this time for novel coronavirus 2019. It is mainly supportive measures, and antivirals. There are no specific antivirals that treat this infection.
As these numbers continue to increase, this is the middle of the flu season for a lot of the planet. How does this affect those hospital systems and those care systems already dealing with a large number of people who are getting sick?
So I think that's a very good point. We are currently in the United States, but also worldwide, in the Western Hemisphere, we're dealing with an unusual influenza season. The number of deaths that we see with influenza annually is exceedingly high if we consider that this is a vaccine-preventable disease. We have each year more than 30,000 deaths in the U.S. alone due to influenza. So clearly, it does affect what we do in the healthcare environment.
That's Dr. Francesca Torriani from UC San Diego Health. The World Health Organization's Director for Global Infectious Hazard Preparedness says the coronavirus is not yet a pandemic.
We are at the phase where it's an epidemic with multiple foci, and we will try to extinguish the transmission in each of these foci.
She added that the WHO has no evidence that the virus is changing or mutating and called it a stable virus. Daniel Arap Moi, a former school teacher who became Kenya's longest-serving president and presided over years of repression and economic turmoil fueled by runaway corruption, has died. He was 95. Moi's death was announced by President Uhuru Kenyatta in a statement on the state broadcaster Tuesday. Despite his suppression of critics, Moi is recalled fondly by many Kenyans who credit him with popular programs such as providing free milk to poor school children. Moi, who ruled Kenya for 24 years, has been in the hospital for over a month. India's ruling Hindu nationalist-led government said Tuesday it was still weighing whether to roll out a nationwide citizenship registry, an exercise it says would weed out illegal foreign nationals. There are ongoing protests against a citizenship law that fast-tracks naturalization for some religious minorities from three neighboring countries. Opponents of the law say it discriminates because it excludes Muslims and unconstitutional because it links faith to citizenship in a secular country. Critics fear the registry, coupled with the new law, could leave millions stateless, a fear that the government has dismissed. The Fars News Agency says authorities in Tehran have sentenced a man to death in Iran for allegedly spying for the CIA. He was accused of attempting to pass on information about Tehran's nuclear program and will be executed soon. In another case, Fars quotes the judiciary spokesman announcing that two people working for a charity were sentenced to 10 years in prison for spying and 5 years in prison for acting against national security on similar charges. Before members of Congress gathered to hear U.S. President Donald Trump's State of the Union address Tuesday evening, senators will have the chance to give speeches on the floor of the chamber explaining where they stand on the president's impeachment trial. The speeches by the senators who are serving as jurors in the trial are not officially part of the trial itself and are unlikely to make much difference in the senators' expected acquittal of Trump when they cast their final vote on Wednesday. Joining us now from Capitol Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So what can you tell us about this day of speeches by these senators in the impeachment hearing?
Well, I think what's important to remember is that, as you mentioned, while this doesn't have any actual bearing on the trial itself, it is a very important exercise for these 100 senators who have spent the last 2.5 weeks really unable to express themselves about what is the most important political event of their generation. Remember, the rules of the impeachment trial mean that they had to sit in their seats and not speak. Then they were only able to submit written questions during the question and answer part of the trial process. This was really their opportunity to speak to their constituents, to their voters, to outline their thought process on how they're going to be voting on impeachment Wednesday. And again, you know, we're in a 2020 election year. A third of the U.S. Senate is up for re-election. So some of these senators are really making the case to their voters about why they should be re-elected after making this decision.
Right. And you brought up that a third of the Senate is up. This is an election year. You know, the Democrats are trying to say going into the impeachment hearing that this is their constitutional duty. Are we going to see the same the partisan kind of remarks from the Democrats and the Republicans throughout this day?
Well, so far, we've had some of the senators' remarks on the floor beginning yesterday. What we've seen so far is definitely that partisan gap where you have Democratic senators getting up and saying that this is an absolute threat to the nation, a threat to American democracy, and most importantly, a threat to the upcoming presidential election. And that's why Democrats felt like they had to move so quickly on this impeachment trial. And then on the other hand, you have Republicans getting up and saying that this is nowhere near the level of an impeachable offense, that this whole process has been the fruit of the poisonous tree. That's what Senator Murkowski from Alaska said yesterday, that everything is just so riddled with partisanship in the media environment, in the way the process was handled, that they absolutely cannot impeach a president for this. So pretty much seen some of the expected reactions on both sides.
We have about 30 seconds left. Tonight is the State of the Union address. What is going to be the president's theme?
Be really interesting. What I'm waiting to see and hear from is whether or not the president addresses impeachment, because look, this is a really unusual situation that you have a president of the United States giving his annual State of the Union address the day before he's expected to be acquitted in a Senate impeachment trial. That's something that's never happened in this country, and I don't see Trump avoiding commenting on the fact that he's about to be acquitted.
VOA's congressional correspondent is Catherine Hill. She's Catherine Gibson. She's joining us from Capitol Hill. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And still to come,
the World Health Organization reports cancer is on the increase globally, but it says preventive measures can save the lives of millions of cancer sufferers over the next decade.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
You're enjoying a good night's sleep when suddenly you're roused out of your dreams by the sound of your alarm clock. When you do wake up, are you usually alert and ready to face a new day, or are you groggy and find it hard to become fully functional? A new study from Australia's Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology suggests the sounds you wake up to could affect your morning disposition. The paper, published in the journal PLOS ONE, suggests that waking up to melodic sounds, like your favorite song, may improve your level of alertness. However, study researchers found that being awakened by harsh alarm sounds was linked to increased levels of morning blurriness or sleep inertia. Study authors say their findings could be important to those who must be at their peak soon after waking. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The vaunted Iowa caucuses, the first test of the U.S. Democratic presidential candidate's strength in challenging U.S. President Donald Trump in the 2020 election, hit an embarrassing roadblock late Monday when the state Democratic Party was unable to report even a single vote tallied hours after the polls had closed. Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Troy Price explained why the results of the caucus were delayed in a conference call with the media.
We want to emphasize that this is a reporting issue, not a hack or an intrusion. And it's exactly why we have a paper trail and systems in place to uphold the integrity of our process. We are validating every piece of data we have against our paper trail. That system is taking longer than expected, but it's in place to ensure we are eventually able to report results with full confidence.
But in a contest that is important for its status in setting the tone of the campaign and assessing the viability of the candidates in a crowded field, the lack of any official sense of winners or losers meant top performers do not have the usual ability to claim victory and subsequent momentum heading into next week's New Hampshire primary. Now, to break down the importance of the delay and the impact it may have moving forward, I spoke earlier with Professor Matthew Kerbel, a political scientist at Villanova University.
Well, I think the immediate impact is that the candidates who would have done well in Iowa on Monday are denied the opportunity to have that moment in prime time as the ballots are being counted. That typically leads to momentum for candidates who either do better than expected or win. And while as of now we don't know who that would have been, it seems that Bernie Sanders, by all indications from his campaign, expected to win or to come very close to winning. That obviously would have been a big story. Pete Buttigieg, as well, went on television at 11:30 last night, gave a rousing victory address, but he did it without the benefit of actually knowing if he had won, because none of the votes had been counted. But he did it because he needed that moment. That was the time in front of America when he could claim victory and use that to propel his campaign into New Hampshire. And now both those candidates have lost that opportunity. When we talk about who may have benefited from the mix-up in Iowa, Joe Biden was able to sneak out of Iowa without actually having to face questions about a poor performance. If the indications that are coming out of some of the other campaigns are true, it's conceivable that Biden has done poorly in Iowa, and maybe quite poorly. We don't know yet. But if that's the case, then that really could have undermined his campaign tremendously. You know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation at a time when we still don't know the outcome, and we still don't know how the outcome is going to be interpreted, because we've really never been in a situation like this before, where not only do we not know on Tuesday morning, but we have a State of the Union address coming up tonight, and the completion of an impeachment trial coming up on Wednesday. And by the time we get to Thursday, who knows where we're going to be? And then, of course, the New Hampshire primary is next week.
Going into New Hampshire, which by law of their state constitution has to be the first primary in the U.S. But these are two fairly small states when it comes to electoral votes. Do these contests really matter in the grand scheme of things?
It's important in terms of the campaign narrative, because they are the first contests, and because of that they receive outsized press attention. So candidates who win or do better than expected in the early contests experience historically a kind of bandwagon effect, which affects their fundraising and affects their future prospects. Conversely, there are candidates that fall below expectations, have trouble raising money, their support starts to dry up, and they eventually have to leave the race. So this has been a problem for the parties for a very long time. And of course, one of the things that we hear about Iowa is that it's such a demographically unrepresentative state, both of the nation and particularly the Democratic coalition, that for it to have this kind of influence is really inappropriate. So if there is a silver lining coming out of the mess that happened in Iowa on Monday, it may be that discussion of whether the Iowa caucus should continue to be the first contest. I think those discussions are now going to be turbocharged.
That was Matthew Kerbel, a political scientist at Villanova University. The World Health Organization reports cancer is on an increase globally, but it says preventative measures can save the lives of millions of cancer patients over the next decade. Lisa Schlein has that story for today. Tuesday, February 4th, is World Cancer Day.
Over the past decade, nearly every country in the world has seen an increase in the number of cancer patients. The World Health Organization reports 1 in 6 people will develop cancer in their lifetime, causing at least 10 million deaths from this disease every year. If current trends continue, WHO warns new cancer cases will rise by 60% by 2040, more than 80% in low and middle-income countries. The technical officer in cancer control at WHO, Andre Ilbawi, says more people are dying from cancer in the poorer countries because they lack the services and cancer control measures that exist in the richer countries. He says controlling the disease does not have to be expensive.
Our report presents the first investment case from WHO for cancer services, that governments, by investing in cancer, can save 7 million lives by 2030. And that is at the cost of $2.70 per person in low-income countries and $8.15 per person in upper-middle-income countries. This is feasible.
WHO says cancer does not have to be a death sentence. Prevention works. The director of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, Elisabetta Vidopas, says there have been tremendous advances in research on cancer prevention and treatment, and these are successfully keeping many people alive who otherwise would have died.
Preventive policies such as the elimination of occupational exposures to carcinogens, tobacco control measures, vaccination against cancer-causing infectious agents, and screening for early stages of cancer are potentially powerful ways to reduce not only the average incidence and mortality for cancer, but also socioeconomical inequalities in cancer occurrence.
In its report, WHO highlights a wide range of measures proven to be effective in preventing new cancer cases. For example, it notes tobacco-related diseases account for 25% of cancer deaths. Quitting this deadly habit, it says, can save billions of dollars and millions of lives. WHO says a vaccine against hepatitis B can prevent liver cancer. It notes another vaccine against HPV, the most common sexually transmitted infection, can virtually eliminate cervical cancer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Many Rohingya were injured after guns were fired at the Nayapara Muchani refugee camp in Bangladesh Monday night. At least 14 injured Rohingyas were admitted to Cox's Bazar's District Sadar Hospital, and a few who were critically injured were referred to the Chittagong Media College Hospital for better treatment. In addition, two women were killed and seven others were injured January 25th when a Rohingya village in the Rakhine state came under artillery fire. The Myanmar military has rejected accusations that it was responsible for the shelling, which came 2 days after the United Nations highest court ordered that Myanmar protect Rohingya. Saudi Arabia's top diplomat says his country does not want U.S. troops to leave Iraq, even as Washington bolsters its military presence in the Saudi kingdom. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud warned that any pullout of American troops from neighboring Iraq could make the region less safe. Dale Gavlak has that story.
The United States has roughly 5,000 troops stationed in Iraq, which support and advise Iraqi forces in the ongoing fight against Islamic State militants, also known as IS, mainly in the country's north. Iraq resumed joint military operations last week with the U.S.-led coalition to fight Islamic State after a nearly 3-week pause that followed heightened tensions with Baghdad over Washington's targeted killing of a top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, on Iraqi soil in January. The Iraqi military, however, also hinted that Baghdad's relationship with Washington would change after Iraq's parliament voted recently to expel the U.S. military. Washington says it does not intend to pull troops out of Iraq. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud says the United States acted in its own legitimate self-defense when it targeted Soleimani. The U.S. has proven time and again to be a reliable ally of the Saudi kingdom, and this is also the case with the Trump administration, he said recently in an interview with CNN. Gulf analyst Zinzia Bianco of the European Council on Foreign Relations says Saudi Arabia's position is consistent with its views following the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003.
From the Saudi point of view, the U.S. at the center of managing the waves of instability that have been also in part originated from their own invasion of Iraq. When the region suffers strong waves of instability, the U.S. should be there to deal with them.
Bianco and other analysts say U.S. troops are also viewed as a deterrent to Iran's growing footprint in the region and the instability it has caused. Washington has strengthened America's military presence in the Gulf, especially with more troops added to Saudi Arabia's Prince Sultan Air Base amid rising tensions with Iran.
Especially at this time of heightened tensions between the U.S. and Iran, if the U.S. would have to withdraw its troops from Iraq, stand on the target list of Iran or U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia or other targets in the kingdom itself.
Analysts say Saudi Arabia wants to avoid a direct confrontation with Iran, its powerful regional rival. However, the Trump administration did not step in militarily to defend Saudi interests after what is believed to have been Iran's drone and missile attack on Saudi oil sites last September. Since then, the U.S. has placed 4 Patriot batteries in Saudi Arabia and recently set up Patriot batteries to protect against missiles fired by Iran and Iranian-backed militias in Syria and Iraq. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Riyadh.
And that's going to do it for us today. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Thanks for joining us.